How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We turn now to a topic that we'll be digging into all week on this show. Now, a quick backstory. If you listen to Reset pretty often, you'll know that we cover immigration regularly. From how new legislation out of the White House is impacting you and your neighbors in Chicago and Illinois, to the personal stories of migrants who journeyed here from the southern border. But for the Reset team, those conversations continue off the air. Those personal stories, well, they sit with us. And we're constantly working to bring even more of what some local immigrant families here are really facing to your radios. Now, there's a ton of noise and rhetoric out there, I know, about who gets to live, work, and belong in the U.S., and who doesn't, and who's got the power to take away the rights of immigrants, and when. So all week on this program, we're breaking down the often complicated immigration process for various visas, whether you're here as a skilled worker, or by marriage, or as a college student, or even a refugee. In this first installment, our conversation focused on U.S. permanent residents, also known as green card holders. And what's in it for you? Well, clarity and insight. Our panel is going to get you caught up on the latest with the ever-changing national policies. They'll explain what you may not know about the grueling, lengthy immigration process. And we're learning more about the lived experiences of our guests. At the table was Tejas Shah, a local immigration lawyer. Sharda, who's a Chicago resident and green card holder. Now, Sharda is a pseudonym. And Judith is a Chicago resident and green card holder as well. Given the increased fear these days, it was a bit of a challenge for us to find folks who were willing to share their personal stories on the topic. So in order to protect their identities, several of our guests that you'll hear from this week will use pseudonyms or just their first name. For this conversation, Tejas started us off by telling us the basics of what a green card is.
A green card holder, and backstory, you know, they're called green cards because a couple of decades ago, the little documents that they had were green in color, is essentially somebody who's considered a lawful permanent resident. A lawful permanent resident is somebody who has sort of the unrestricted right to live and work in the United States, to travel freely in and out of the country. But what's important to recognize is that a lawful permanent resident is also not an American citizen. A green card or permanent resident status can be lost for a variety of different reasons more easily than citizenship can be lost. And I know we're going to dig into this further, but you know, to really want to emphasize that it is a grueling, grueling process, often involving decades for many individuals to get the right to be considered a permanent resident of the United States.
Yeah, I appreciate the distinction there between a green card and citizenship, which is sort of, you know, the ultimate goal on your immigration journey. But what's the difference, would you say, between like having a green card and having a visa, right? Lots of people are here on different visas.
Yeah, so a basic distinction that you want to keep in mind is that many individuals who have visas have a limited ability to be here. Maybe that visa is dependent on maintaining employment with a particular U.S. employer. Maybe you're on an H-1B or an O-1 or a TN or some other type of work visa. If you lose that job, you could lose that status and the ability to live and work in the United States. Maybe your status is tied to your ability to maintain that employment. Whereas if you're a permanent resident, you could choose to be unemployed. You could choose to do what you want to do in the United States, and your status is not going to be tied to your ability to maintain an underlying condition of that visa. So
I see.
The basic distinction is between, you know, sort of the unrestricted right to live and work in the United States in any field that you want to or not work versus, you know, sort of being admitted to the United States for a very specific purpose for a limited period of time, which is typically what's associated with most visas.
Yeah. And the primary pathways to getting a green card, I'd love for you to clear that up. I know a lot of people, especially with the popularity of shows like 90 Day Fiancé out there, a lot of people think, you know, you got to get married to someone. That's how you become a green card holder. True, but that's not the only way.
Correct. That is not the only way. And so broadly speaking, you really have four general pathways that you can use, right? You have the employment-based side, which some individuals can apply on their own for green cards, but the vast majority of individuals who are going the quote-unquote employer-sponsored route need a U.S. employer that is willing to sponsor them. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that, if you don't, or you lose your employment at some point, that may jeopardize your ability to pursue a green card through that path. Second pathway is through what we call the family-based pathway. So maybe you marry an American citizen, which is what 90 Day Fiancé is highlighting.
It's all about that, yes.
Exactly. Maybe you have a sibling that is an American citizen, or maybe you have a spouse that's a legal permanent resident, or you're an adult son or daughter of a U.S. citizen. Many of those pathways, though, are going to take years and years, if not decades, for you to get your green card. Then we have a third and fourth pathway. The third pathway is the diversity visa lottery, which is really only going to apply to people whose nationality is underrepresented in the United States. And then the fourth pathway is really through what we would call the humanitarian ways to enter the United States. Folks who are granted asylum and are admitted as asylees, refugees, maybe somebody who's granted a U visa or a T visa. This doesn't necessarily sort of represent the entire universe of categories, but those four pathways are really the vast majority.
Yeah, most popular.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Sharda, let's bring you in here and learn more about your personal story. Your journey began as a student, am I right?
Yeah.
So tell us more.
I moved to the U.S. as an international student pursuing my doctorate at a U.S. university. I then got my PhD and had an academic job opportunity on hand. And so I transitioned to an H-1B visa. That H-1B visa was through the non-lottery system called the cap-exempt process, which provides, or at least at that time, provided sort of limitless visas to people who had doctoral degrees, who were pursuing, and they just can fact check me on this, pursuing academic or research-oriented roles in institutions like universities or that resembled universities.
Okay.
From that...
So we're talking high-level positions here, right?
Right, exactly. So I was a professor, right? And from there, my journey deviated from other professorial positions in that I made the audacious decision as an immigrant on an H-1B visa. I decided that I didn't want to continue on in my job or didn't want to continue being an academic. And I wanted to do more applied social justice driven work.
But your H-1B was tied to that employer.
Yes, my H-1B was tied to the university that I was working for. And that's when my informal degree in immigration law began, because I had to do my own research, talk to friends, talk to people who had more experience in immigration than I did, more lived experience immigration than I did. And I realized that as long as I could keep on applying for research positions at nonprofit research institutions, I could potentially both pursue my aspirations about wanting to do social justice driven work and continue being on a work visa.
And stay in the country.
Yeah. I do want to, at this point, just add that my dream when I came into this country wasn't, you know, to gain citizenship or to, that the U.S. wasn't showing up in my homeland.
You weren't here for the American dream.
I wasn't here for the American dream. I was 23 and wanting to leave my home and not ask my parents for money. And I wanted to pursue a doctorate, but the U.S. was the only set of universities that offered, financial assistantship and tuition waivers and so on for a doctoral program. And, you know, as many other people may experience, once you get on a journey, it's, you know, you sort of see what the next step is and you kind of keep going.
Life starts to life.
Yeah,
it starts to take you in different directions.
Right. And, I remember reading somewhere that most Americans don't ever end up leaving the town or the city where they were born. And so if that's the case, then one may empathize with the fact that you can continue making choices to evolve your life in a certain direction without pursuing the American dream. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Yes, very good distinction. Let me hear Judith's story. Yours is a little different. Tell us how you got here to the United States.
I moved here as an immigrant from Cameroon. Running away from war, going to seek refuge somewhere. And America wasn't actually the first place I was thinking of, but this was where I landed. Mm-hmm. And went through the asylum processes. And after the asylum process, which took a while because it was during the COVID period, ooh, which things were a little...
So did it take years, months?
It took years. And right now it's still taking years, you know. And after the time, finally asylum was granted. And what next? You have to go in for the green card application, which took a little longer with the backlog and all that. So, yeah, that was just...
I mean, especially if this is all happening during the COVID period.
Yes.
Tejas, you're nodding because, I mean, you've seen the backlog really impact families.
Oh, mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, We were talking off camera about the fact that I had a client several years ago who was an asylum applicant from Africa who waited 6 years for an interview to be scheduled on his asylum claim. And that was 8 years of separation from his family, you know, while he mm-hmm. was in the United States. So and that, unfortunately, at this point is a feature of our immigration system as opposed to a bug, because we simply haven't made the changes in decades that are needed to.
Yeah.
Really modernize our immigration system.
So, Judith, did any of that happen to you? Did you get separated from your family? I understand you have kids,
yes,
right?
Yes, I got separated from my kids. And
did you?
Yeah, it took a while.
How old were they?
They were 11 years old at the time, and I moved here heavily pregnant and a young son of 3 years old, and left back their dad and the two other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So where is everyone now?
Everyone is united with me in Chicago. Yes.
All the kids are here.
All the kids are here.
And your status now is?
A green card holder.
So you're now a green card holder.
Yes.
But it was a journey.
It was a journey.
And what about the kids? Did your status sort of trickle down to them?
Yes. So being a green card holder, there was a petition that I had to do where after I gained my asylum, which could enable the kids come in here. And then after a year, they have to apply for their green cards, which that's the in process because of the backlog. So we're still waiting on that.
Has the process, Tejas, for the green card changed over the years, like getting it? Is it more difficult? Anecdotally, I hear stories all the time. Went through my own journey. It was difficult. I will say that. I can't imagine that it was like it could get worse than how it feels right now. But you tell me. I mean, you're the professional who's been doing this for a while. Have you seen changes?
Well, I'd answer that question in two ways. By first noting that the fundamental framework, as I mentioned earlier, has not really changed to a substantial degree, right? We have had this framework in place for really decades now that sort of governs what are the categories through which you can get a green card, what are the pathways that are available, and what are the steps involved. I think the challenge and what's made it more challenging over, you know, the last few decades is that, you know, we've installed quotas on, you know, these various different types of visas, right? So we have quotas and people trying to get their green cards through their brothers and sisters mm-hmm. or through an employer. And for some nationalities, and in the case of some categories for all nationalities, those quotas are frankly quite absurdly low. You know, you could end up waiting a decade plus, maybe a couple of decades if you're, you know, waiting on a green card through your brother or sister who's an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you take those sorts of wait times and then you take, you know, normal life, right? Somebody wants to make a transition from being a professor to working in social justice, you know, whereas for my parents, you know, who immigrated here in the 70s and 80s, you know, maybe it was more like a 5 or 6 year process. Now it's a 2-decade process. Well, what does that mean for your children?
Wow.
Right? Are they aging out? What does that mean for your own ability to maintain your status in the United States if you're going through an economic downturn and people are being laid off? And so in that sense, while the process itself may not have fundamentally changed, the sort of structure of the system,
yeah,
the way I think about it is that it's outdated and it's not well suited for the way American society is evolving and the demands of immigration today.
Mm. So I want to play a clip here. This is from our Vice President, J.D. Vance, and this is how he talks about folks with your status.
A green card holder, even if I might like that green card holder, doesn't have an indefinite right to be in the United States of America, right? American citizens have different rights from people who have green cards, from people who have student visas. And so my attitude on this is, this is not fundamentally about free speech. And to me, yes, it's about national security, but it's also more importantly about who do we, as an American public, decide gets to join our national community? And if the Secretary of State and the President decide this person shouldn't be in America and they have no legal right to stay here, it's as simple as that.
Sharda and Judith, you had some facial expressions that I want to hear what's going through your mind. Verbalize that for me, Sharda. What are you thinking?
Yeah, In some ways, I think J.D. Vance has, yeah, sort of set out what the hierarchy of rights and people are in this country. It's not the only hierarchy, as we know, but it is one of the hierarchies. And I think what came to my mind from my personal story here is that so I came through an employer, my green card is through employer sponsorship.
Yeah.
And it is through a very niche pathway in the employer-sponsored green card, which is the EB-1B, which is immigrants with extraordinary ability.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which the fact that my legal right to be in this country is through me demonstrating my contribution, mm-hmm, to the settler colonial project, that is the U.S. empire, is something that, you know, decades of cold showers isn't going to cleanse from me.
So it's like a prove you belong here.
And it is
prove
literally
you have a
in
right
a
to stay here.
Sorry. Yes. And literally in form of documentation. So in terms of a grueling process, it wasn't that the time taken for my green card was grueling, because as an Indian national, the EB-1B extraordinary ability process actually took a year, mm-hmm, from the date of submission to my green card being in my mailing, my
right
mailbox.
Right.
But the process of going through the demonstration of proving that I am quote unquote better than the other immigrants was, mm-hmm, nonsensical.
Yeah. Lot of paperwork to submit, right?
Lots of paperwork to submit, especially in a system that also has historically prioritized STEM and scientists as people with extraordinary ability, mm-hmm, that have more objective metrics of impact and so on and so forth. And my process was not easy, even within this extraordinary ability process, because again, at every point I felt what J.D. Vance is describing as the U.S. state's ability to box people in and, mm-hmm, say, this is how you contribute. If you don't contribute in that way, we are going to make your life harder.
Yeah.
Or it's time to go, as in what we are seeing with the disappearances of Mahmoud Khalil, of the Turkish student, of the Iranian student, of the, yeah, Indian student, so on and so forth, even as they were our permanent green card,
yeah,
holders.
That's a very, very valid set of points there. Judith, you too seemed perplexed when you heard what J.D. Vance had to say. What do you feel about that language being used to talk about People like yourself.
Basically, they're trying to tell us that we are guests in the U.S. and we should act as guests in the U.S., which I don't think that's the right word that's supposed to use to immigrants. Why? Because we came in here legally and we're doing what the nation is required for us to do. We work, we pay our taxes, we do participate in whatever we're supposed to. So mm-hmm. I guess we have legal rights to stay in the U.S. And
see, that sounds like more than a guest.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So Tejas, I mean, piggybacking off of that Vance clip, you know, language that we're also seeing from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services or USCIS. If you go to the website, it talks about green cards and visas are a privilege, not a right. There's a tweet back in April from USCIS saying, quote, if you're a guest in our country, act like it. So clear it up for us. Are green card holders guests and aliens?
Yeah. And so I intend for this not to be political, but I intend for this to really be about sort of factual, you know, what does the law say, right? I'm an immigration lawyer. My job is to protect my clients. I sort of view my role as being somebody who's going to stand up for the rule of law and protect my clients from government overreach, regardless of political ideology. And I would say that that clip overstates or understates the rights of permanent residents, in my opinion. Right. And I think it's a clip that's, you know, offered up in furtherance of sort of a particular viewpoint that the administration has, which is that they have the broad ability under foreign policy doctrines to potentially take away somebody's green card. I think the truth is much more complex than that, right? And I think we're seeing that play out in courts as, you know, some of these issues are being litigated. Mm-hmm. The reality is, you know, permanent residents do have, you know, fairly broad First Amendment rights. With all that being said, I think a lot of this language and rhetoric is sort of promoting a sense of uncertainty and fear, right? And maybe there's a design to promote a certain degree of uncertainty and fear for immigrants of all hues, of all statuses, to sort of maybe perhaps chill some of the comments that they might otherwise make.
Yeah.
By sort of communicating and hammering this idea of temporariness to individuals over and over again. And so from my perspective, you know, if I'm having that conversation with a client who's a permanent resident who says, oh my gosh, you know, I posted this one tweet, you know, expressing a particular view, I would say to them, look, you know, you're going to have to make a decision about what you're comfortable with, but you do have certain rights in this country as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to recognize that.
There's a lot of fear. I started out this conversation by talking about, you know, people, the reaction to what's coming out seemingly every week from the Trump administration, changes, different policies. Is it scary, Judith and Charter, for you to share your story today? Is there a fear at all?
It is a little scary, and on one part, and on the other part, it's not.
What gives you the confidence to talk to us today?
What gives me the confidence is that I believe being a green card holder, I do have certain rights, and I definitely practice my rights. I do not commit crimes, and I do pay my taxes, and like Sean said earlier ago, is if we are guests do not have to work, you know, but we're doing all that, which means we have the rights to really stay here. So those things gives me the confidence.
Yeah.
And on the other side, it's you do not know what awaits you tomorrow, you know.
It's been so unpredictable, Sharda,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I, you know, the fact that I asked for my real name not to be used here is...
That says something.
It's the first time I'm taking these sets of precautions. And that's under advisement from my immigration lawyer to put my personal story out there, but to also balance what it means to be... A green card holder.
Yeah, protect yourself.
And to protect myself. Yeah. And I think that I'm also more safe, or I should say more stable in terms of my rights in this country, as Tejas was saying, compared to when I was on a student visa and a work visa. And at least for me as a person and as someone who works in social justice, who organizes in community outside of my job, my endeavor is to always try and locate my strength and my autonomy.
Right.
I'm out in the streets for yeah. Palestine and for other causes that I deeply believe in. And this whole political landscape at the moment has actually made me realize and think more deeply about what are the ways in which I can still show up for my community
yeah.
and show up for myself and the things that I believe in,
mm-hmm.
but possibly doing it differently from the ways that I was showing up before.
Yeah, there's always still an underlying risk, if you will, but to what extent are you going to not fight for what you believe in or stand up for what
exactly.
you believe in? You know, I'm reminded of you bringing up your own parents' story earlier, Tejas, and just, you know, kind of back in the, it was the 70s, you said.
80s. And 80s, yeah.
Yeah. And a producer and I were talking, you know, weeks ago when we started sort of drumming up this idea to bring this conversation on the program. And we're just talking about how there just seems to be a disconnect these days, that the narrative of like the right and wrong way
right.
to come here. You know, you'll hear sometimes people say, well, my parents are immigrants, but they did it the right way.
Right.
You know, and not knowing that people are still doing it the right way.
Yeah.
You shouldn't believe or just sort of focus only on the narratives that you're seeing play out, you know, from Washington and just all over social media.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's a very true statement, right? I think that there's a lack of understanding on folks, you know, once you sort of get to the next generation or two generations down from whoever it was that immigrated to the United States. Immigration law is an evolving thing and it's changed so much. And
mm-hmm.
and so when we talk about, you know, coming the right way, well, the right way may have looked very different and may have been easier, you know, a couple of decades ago compared to what it looks like right now. And so I think that everyone, if there's one takeaway I would ask all our listeners to have, it's to have a little bit more empathy and understanding for just the immense challenges that individuals seeking to immigrate to the United States have to face today.
Absolutely. And we'll leave it there. Tejas Shah is an immigration lawyer here in Chicago. Sharda is a Chicago resident and green card holder, and Judith is also a Chicago resident and green card holder. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Micah Yasin. It was edited by Dan Tucker and Meha Ahmed. On Reset, we bring you conversations with insight, critique, and curiosity that respond to what's happening and how it affects us. Hit the subscribe button to stay with us or visit wbez.org/reset to stay up to date. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll meet again this afternoon.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.